Hi, this is David Russell. Welcome to episode 29 of the No Bad Bosses podcast. Today's episode is sponsored by Dave's Charm School, which is soft skills training for your employees. People don't show up with perfect soft skills. You got to train them. You got to hold them accountable. You got to work them through typical scenarios. That's what Charm School is all about. So visit managetowin.com/charm school to learn more. Now, my guest today is Kevin Marks. He's the managing director of Passion Publishing. He has for-profit experience and nonprofit experience, great experience overall. He's got some fantastic tips for you that he learned from his mentors. Don't miss it. Here we go. Okay, we're live. So I'm here with Kevin Marks, Managing Director of Passion Publishing. And you know, Kevin, it's really striking me. This is nuts. I'm in Thomasville, Georgia. I'm three and a half hours from you. I should have scheduled my flights differently.
That's crazy.
I could have been sitting in the same room.
That's right.
So can you give a little intro, backgrounder on your background as a leader and then what you're doing today? That'd be great for our audience.
Absolutely. Happy to. And thanks for having me on, David. It's just a privilege to be with you today and excited about our conversation. And so my background is in book publishing, at least most of my background. And so going back to 1991, I stepped into a role at Multnomah Publishers as a sales manager and had no idea that that was going to lead me on to a path of being there for 17 years and did various things in the publishing world, sales, marketing, and then stepped over to be a publisher of a couple of our divisions and just learned a lot in those years for sure. In 2007 ended up selling the company at a Random House. And I ended up staying in Oregon where our publishing company was located and stepped into an executive pastor role because that's what every publisher does. They typically go from publishing to executive pastor role.
I think that should go the reverse, right?
Yeah, that's a whole other conversation in and of itself for sure. And I did that for 6 years. And so I went from a for-profit environment to a nonprofit, volunteer-based environment. And then did that for 6 years. And then started feeling the itch to go back into publishing. And a really unique opportunity popped up for me here at Passion. And I'll tell you a little bit about Passion in a little bit. But Passion Publishing is a publishing organization under the umbrella of Passion Ministries. So isn't it crazy that I was 17 years in a publishing environment, 6 years in a ministry environment, and now I'm doing publishing in a ministry environment. Been doing that for about the past 4 years. So it's crazy how the tapestry always comes together.
Yeah. It seems like there was a plan there.
Yeah.
So talk to me about Passion. What's Passion doing? Because my understanding is you guys got one of the most dynamic ministries going on in the country.
Yeah, Passion is an absolutely dynamic ministry. And a little bit of the backstory, when I was at Multnomah, I had the privilege of publishing books with all sorts of amazing authors. And one of my very favorite was Louis Giglio. And Louis and Shelley Giglio started Passion about 22 years ago, 1995, and we had a chance to publish his books in the early 2000s. And little did I know that all these years later, I would be coming to work for Louis at Passion. And Passion is a ministry that is multifaceted, has a global impact all around the world. So Passion is a church, Passion City Church here in Atlanta, Georgia. We have two locations. Plus, there'll be a new Passion City Church starting next year in Washington, D.C. We just announced that. We have Passion Conferences, which has had a beautiful legacy of reaching out to college students all around the world. And typically, we have an annual conference. Get this, David, an annual conference that brings together college students from all around the country and all around the world. Last year, we had 55,000 college students at the Georgia Dome in early January from every state in our country and over 90 countries around the world. And so Passion's had the opportunity to do that. We also have a record label that is producing music for the church, and tens of thousands of churches every week are singing some of the songs that are coming out of our record label here. And then the new kid on the block is Passion Publishing. And our job is to take the messages of our ministry, amplify them, and then export them all around the world.
Wow. And I didn't realize, I don't know why, but I thought Louis was located in Tennessee. I don't know why. So I got to schedule my next flight that comes down here through Atlanta and come out on Saturday instead of Sunday.
Absolutely.
So I can come and experience the church. I'm going to do that.
We'll host you. We would love that.
Oh, that'd be an honor, but that would be a lot of fun. So, you know, one of the things, so what we try to do, we have this mantra of no bad bosses, which is a little bit challenging because, you know, it is kind of a negative statement.
Right.
But we're trying to encourage people to candidly look at their bad habits and make other choices. And here you've got the for-profit side, the nonprofit side, you've got this blending thing going on. What are some of the things that stand out to you as far as whether you want to talk about whether it's your personal bad bosses, you know, habits that you've overcome or things you've seen in other people, or you want to just focus on the positive side of, hey, I had this mentor that was just incredible or whatever. I mean, when you think back, I mean, you've been in business, at least if I was counting right, I mean, you're approaching 30 years or more, right? You probably got some things, some stories that stick in your mind, good or bad, that could really help the audience comprehend how they can be better leaders.
Yeah, and we can go a lot of different directions. You might want to clarify for your viewers and listeners whether I'm supposed to be the example of the bad boss or the good boss. You know, that's why you invited me on your program here.
Oh, well, I can clarify that real quickly. So when I lived in Sisters, Oregon for 6.5 months earlier this year, I made 2 really close friendships and then started on a third and fourth with some guys who were fantastic. One of the 2 guys who were close was Mark Reifschneider and then Jerry Caping of Westside. But Mark said, as we were just kind of talking, I was my background and stuff, he said, oh, you know, you got to talk with Kevin Marks. I mean, Kevin has a background in publishing. He's been a leader. He's got some different stuff. It's too bad he doesn't live in Sisters anymore because you guys really would have hit it off. And so that's like, oh, I should at least call him to be on the podcast and, you know, get to know him a little bit. Kick it off.
Yeah, that's great. That's great.
So it's all positive.
Well, that's good. He told you a bunch of lies, basically, but that's okay. That's what good friends do. So where would you like to go? Get me back on track here, David.
Well, so let's talk about the for-profit environment to start.
Yeah.
Think about your publishing, Multnomah Publishers. You really climbed the ranks there. You were there 17 years. So you had bosses. You were the boss. What strikes you as some key lessons you learned there?
Gosh, I recall, I think the first lesson is just understanding, especially when you become a new leader, just understanding the influence that a leader has. And sometimes I think the whole concept of influence and authority can get a little mixed up, that leadership is not necessarily authority, but leadership is always influence. For better or worse, it's influence. And I remember early on, and so at a fairly young age, I started kind of, you're right, moving up the ranks, and I became a vice president of sales when I was 29 years old. And I remember stepping into that role. And I remember wanting to do so well. You know, I had been a sales manager for a few years. And you step into a role and you had all these ideas about, man, if I was leading this department, if I was leading this area, this is what I would do. So I had all these plans. I had all these goals. This is how it's going to work. But really early on, I got a simple yet profound lesson. You know, I could be very task oriented. I'm a plan your work your plan kind of a guy. And I remember one day I was coming out of my office and I was going up to my boss's office to talk to him about a promotion we were working on, a couple initiatives, and I was completely focused on what I was doing. I came out of my office, walked by 2 or 3 people, went up the stairs, sat down, had my meeting, came back down, and I didn't think anything of it. And about 2 hours later, my assistant, her name was Linda, came into my office almost in tears. And I was like, Linda, what's wrong? And she said, earlier today, I looked at you and I said hello, and you didn't say a thing to me. You just walked right by, and I'm wondering what's wrong. What happened? You know, did I do something wrong? Are you unhappy with my performance? What's going on? And I thought, wow, for better or worse, leaders, the spotlight is always on, and we are always impacting the people around us and the world around us. And I remember that at that moment, that young age for me, just remembering that, man, if I'm going to be a leader that's going to have influence, if I'm going to be a leader that really helps my people, I'm going to have to be someone that really sees people. Even when I'm on a task, even when I'm going 1,000 miles an hour, I can't be so busy that I can't slow down and look someone in the eyes and say hello and how's your day. And so that was, for me, one of my early lessons that's informed a lot of what I've done since then.
Yeah, it's an interesting lesson. I was at a similar age, just slightly younger, I went into the trade show business, and I was mentored by a guy, and he told me that when you walk through the show, now you're the show promoter, you know, when you, and it's a similar leadership type of role. When you walk through the show, whether you've got a lot of people attending the show or no one's there, you've got to have a smile on your face. You have to look confident that everything's going okay and be able to greet and engage, you know, the exhibitors, because they'll pick up on your behavior. And recently I had a client who had a similar thing where they were more taking the approach you took. They're just busy. They're right. Concentrating, frown on their face. And they're not mad at anybody, but other people were wondering, like, what's going on? Looks bad.
Right. Yeah, we have a saying here. Louis says it all the time, just to remind us of that point. And he just says the camera is always on. And so, in other words, you have to assume as you're leading that people are watching you, and you just never know. And to reinforce this point, so Louis is a huge Auburn fan, and he goes down to Auburn for just about every game, and a lot of times they have him share at the chapel and so forth. And he's navigated his way into that world where oftentimes he doesn't sit in the stands. He's got a sideline pass where he's there. And so there was one time he was talking about the camera's always on, and then he showed a clip that showed up on CBS Sports of them showing the sideline. And there's Louis. Nobody knows who Louis is who's watching TV. But he's got his arms crossed, and he's got this funny look on his face and a total frown. He's totally focused on what's going on in the game. He's like, the camera's always on. A million people just saw me looking like a goof on the sidelines. And it's just a good example that whether you're leading from up front, that's an obvious one, or just walking through the office, sitting in a meeting, in the lunchroom, that, man, that people are watching and they're aware of who you are, what you're doing, and how you carry yourself.
Yeah. What was that movie decades ago with, I think, Roy Scheider? Was it All That Jazz?
I didn't see it.
It was about some jazz dancers. It was kind of a funky movie, but I only remember one scene, is that every morning it showed him being exhausted, getting up, going to the sink in front of a full-length mirror, and he'd splash water on his face and he'd go, it's showtime, folks.
Okay, here we go.
Yeah, and that's the way he started every morning. And yeah. Then he'd go out and work with these jazz dancers. I don't remember. It wasn't, I don't think, a very positive movie, but, you know,
That's right.
That scene that kind of stuck. So you've got that piece. And I think it's important for leaders to not miss that we're both emphasizing. I think there's an underlying tenet here. We're not asking anyone to be insincere.
No.
You know, or phony in any way, but just to be self-aware of our body language or our facial expression and how other people can pick up on that just because we're thinking or concentrating or whatever.
Yeah. That's right.
I think we might want to mention that too. But you think about that piece, that's interesting, a moment to remember. What else came up there during that time? That was, I mean, here you're this young guy, you're learning, you're climbing the ranks fast, a lot of impact. You guys had a lot of growth back then too, didn't you?
At Multnomah?
Yeah.
Yeah, we did. And so when I joined the company, we were a $9 million company, and we peaked out at $96 million. And We had a few books that sold. They were just rockets. We had one called The Prayer of Jabez that sold 12 million copies. We had another, Secrets of the Vine, that sold 6 million copies. And to give listeners some context of what that means in the publishing world, those particular years, they came out a year apart. But the first one, Prayer of Jabez, just kind of trickled along for the first year, and then it really took off in the second year.
That was Wilkinson, wasn't it? Bruce Wilkinson?
Yeah, Bruce Wilkinson. And those books in that particular year were the number one and number two selling nonfiction books in all of publishing that particular year.
Wow.
And so we saw a lot of crazy growth for sure. And I think one of the lessons, leadership lessons, is it's important to manage the incline and manage growth, but it's also very important to manage the other side of growth as well. And so in the publishing industry, everything is cyclical. Everything is sold on a non-returnable basis. And so for us, we absolutely saw the benefits and the fruits of seeing a publishing organization grow very, very fast. To go from 30 million to 90 million in 2 years is huge, massive growth. But then to see the decline once those books go away, you have to really measure and look at, well, what is our real growth? What is our real trend line for sure? And so there's some big lessons in that as well.
Well, and that's a tough business too, because you only have a lifespan that is so long with those titles to provide strong sales. Then they, you know, it's much lower. So what's the next big thing? You know, what are you doing for me now type of thing?
That's right.
That's challenging.
Yeah.
So how do you manage that cyclical up and down with team members? You know, so they can handle that. That's got to be somewhat stressful on the downside.
Yeah, there's no doubt. And in Multnomah, unfortunately, it resulted in we were at a place for Multnomah where we were profitable, yet because how we had planned on the front end, or lack of planning on the front end as far as cash goes, we were running out of cash while we were still profitable. So it was a very difficult time because we ended up ultimately selling the company. So we sold a profitable company, but because it was privately owned, and I won't get into too much of those details, but because it was privately owned, you know, we were at a place where we either had to take on investors or sell the company, and the owner ultimately decided not to take on investors and it ended up selling the organization. And so I think what I learned during that time is how important communication is and how important authenticity is too. Because when things, as leaders, when things are going well, we could be so quick to want to share the good news, right? Good news is fun to share. But when the news isn't so good, you know, there's a propensity to either not want to share it or a propensity to want to spin it. And so when you don't share it, it creates an environment of distrust. And when you spin it, it creates an environment of a lack of authenticity. And so I think great teams are built on authenticity and they're built on trust. And so for us, being able to navigate that, and if you'd have just shared up front, this is where we're at, you know, and this is where things are headed, you're going to be in a lot better situation. Because when you're spinning or not sharing things, then people's appetite to know more and more and more and more, what are you really hiding? What's the real story? Becomes a very difficult environment to navigate and lead in. And so those were some difficult days for sure when we got into 2006, early parts of 2007.
Yeah, it breeds assumptions, which are dangerous. And a lot of times when I go in and I do my leadership consulting, particularly when I'm on site, but also sometimes in other, you know, remote work that I do, but particularly when I'm on site, one of the main issues is a lack of communication.
For sure.
Yeah. And so I have to shift the habits to over-communicating. And not letting unproductive emotions, you know, crop up because somebody's tone of voice ticks you off, or somebody asks a question you feel is rude, or
right,
whatever. So I gotta work on those things. So then you shift into a nonprofit environment. You still have some employees, but you also got this volunteer base,
right?
And you have a board.
And you have a board.
Yeah, and you got a board. And do you know John Pearson or Mike Pate?
I don't.
So they're down in Orange County. Uh-huh. John Pearson is a specialist on nonprofit boards, particularly Christian nonprofit boards. Wonderful guy. Wrote the 20 Management Buckets book many years ago.
Okay.
But I interviewed him in the No Bad Bosses earlier, and all they talked about was nonprofit boards and the challenges and John's advice, which I'll never forget, of taking at least a minimum of 6 to 12 months to vet a board member. So you really know them. But what type of things did you learn in that environment, whether it was from the board or working with volunteers or working with employees in a nonprofit environment?
Yeah, and so it's interesting what you're saying about the board, because I think, you know, in a nonprofit setting, ideally a board's going to be responsible for two things, you know, in a broader sense. One, picking your leader, and two, setting the limits for that leader, right? And that's typically what they do. But when you get into a church environment, there's a whole different dynamic, you know. So if it's a board for American Cross or, you know, something like that, it's kind of, or for a school or something, you know, boards aren't necessarily quite as hands-on. But in the church environment, it's a different situation, because it's not just about picking your leaders. Now these guys are responsible for the spiritual oversight, if you will, and the spiritual leadership of the church. So board members at a church are much more hands-on, much more involved, much more pastoral and shepherding, if you will. And so that was an interesting environment for me, because I was in a unique role where I was an executive pastor, and that meant day to day, I reported into the senior pastor. But in terms of our overall structure, I also reported into the board. And so I kind of had a dual reporting situation, and I didn't sit on the board, but I attended board meetings. And so it was kind of an interesting dynamic that wasn't necessarily clean cut, but it created a lot of, I think, healthy checks and balances in the communication between the senior pastor and myself, the staff, and the board. And so I think in situations like that, it could, if you have the right people, it can be dynamic. And if you don't have the right people, it can actually be really challenging.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, you've had the for-profit experience and a nonprofit experience. Maybe talk to me about something that you remember as an incident, a story, whatever, from any of your mentors. You've probably had some great mentors over the years.
Man, I've been so blessed to have some great mentors. And the one that comes to mind immediately was a mentor of mine before I was even in a leadership situation, when I was younger. And so his name is Rick Seymour, and he was actually my youth pastor when I was in high school. And Rick was there at a pivotal moment when I think I was making some really major decisions about who I was going to be and where I was going to go in life. And that's why I think youth pastors can be such heroes in so many ways. I was 15 years old. And I really enjoy, I was that 15-year-old who liked to do whatever he could to get a laugh from the crowd, even if it was at someone else's expense. And so here we are. And exactly. That pain in the rear end, 15-year-old, that everyone's like, oh, come on, when's this guy going to grow up? And so here we are in a youth group setting. I have braces, top and bottom. I had them for like 3 or 4 years. And I don't know if you had braces, but back then, you know, a lot of times you had braces, you had rubber bands to kind of control your overbite and all that stuff. And I had figured out, this is honest truth, I had figured out a way to shoot rubber bands out of my mouth at people that were in there. So we were in this youth group setting, and people are wondering right now, where in the world is this story going? And it is going somewhere. So I was being a distraction by doing that. And Rick noticed, he asked me to calm down, and I didn't. And then so I kept doing it, and people are starting to laugh. And all of a sudden, it got to the point where he had had enough. And he looked at me, and he said, Kevin. And as a smart aleck, I looked back at him and said, Rick. Everyone laughed. He goes, can you leave? I said, leave? said, yeah, leave. Now you have to understand, it was a Wednesday night. Our church was out in the middle of nowhere, and I did not drive, and I had nowhere to go. And so I ended up leaving, highly embarrassed, and I just left. And I basically just walked around the church grounds outside, had nothing to do basically but sit there. I couldn't call my parents because I'd have to tell them that I just got kicked out of youth group and needed to come pick me up. So I waited. And so after everything got done and everyone was excused, Rick came and found me, and I was totally ready for him to respond to me like most of the teachers in school would have responded to me, with a lecture, kind of this punitive kind of conversation. When are you going to, you know, why are you messing around? You know, what was going to happen to me? And he came out and he came up and he put his arm around me and he said, Kevin, man, I love you so much. I'm just wondering, when are you really going to start getting serious about life? And I remember at that moment, I just started bawling. And because Rick, because he decided, rather than making a point, he decided he was going to make a difference. And that's a lesson that I've always, always held on to in my leadership roles of, hey, my job is not to win an argument. My job isn't always to make a point. It's always to make a difference. So he kind of gave me the lesson of the power of unconditional love. When he could have come in and dropped a hammer on me, he instead came in and put an arm around me. And what's really crazy about this is the whole reason I ended up working at Multnomah was because years later, Rick Seymour was the sales manager at Multnomah Publishers. And he's the one that called me when I was working for a newspaper, my first job out of college. And he called me three times to convince me to take an interview at Multnomah. And I finally did. And the rest was history. And so you just think of the impact that simple gestures can make. It can be absolutely amazing. So Rick was, in a sense, he was my first mentor and just gave me a profound, profound lesson in life.
You know, it seems to go back to your early point about the influence of leaders. And one approach that I've developed is called good cop, bad cop leadership. And so if you think of good cop, bad cop negotiation, I apply it in leadership. And it's a similar thing that when something goes wrong, I encourage leaders to make the standard, the expectation, the customer expectation, whatever it is, something that's third party be the bad cop. That's the threat. You know, Rick could have come and played whack-a-mole with you, right? You know, you get a line, whack it. But instead, like the good cop, he came alongside and asked you a question.
Yeah.
That ultimately changed your life because he came alongside and said, hey, you know, in essence, when you're ready, I can help you get past this challenge.
That's right.
And instead of playing the whack-a-mole or the bad cop type of thing. So that's cool. That's cool. What about anybody else as another mentor who's had an impact?
Yeah, I would say Doug Gabbert, who was my boss at Multnomah. He was the vice president of sales before he ended up leaving, and then I stepped into his role. And man, Doug was one of the hardest working individuals that I've ever known. And so he taught me the value of work ethic. He taught me the value of keeping your hand on the plow. He taught me the value of seeing things through and sticking with it, even when they get difficult. And I can think of a number of times in various roles where I've wanted to just quit. Maybe something is just feeling too hard, or the goal is feeling too far off in the distance, or whatever. But I go back to Doug. He was a true craftsman, always learning, always investing in his craft. Even, you know, he was this consummate sales guy that had been in sales for decades and decades, and still would set aside significant portions of his time to read books on sales, to go to conferences on sales, to bring that back and invest in us. But he was a hand of the plow guy, and a lot of the work ethic I have today attribute to the modeling that he did for me when I was in my 20s.
You know, I'm curious about that modeling because I had a big influence in my life, my Scottish grandfather, who taught me how to work hard, but he didn't teach me how to work smart.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I'm curious, were there certain aspects of what Rick taught you that was on the smart side, not just the, you know, you're going to see this through, you know, no matter what, or you're going to work harder or whatever type of thing that come to mind at all for you?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, and that's a great point, because I think Doug had both of those gears. So the working hard hand of the plow, sometimes that might just mean I'll just give a little more effort. And there's times when we need to give a little bit more effort, right? We need to see it through. But the other thing that Rick taught,
I blew it. Sorry. I set the bad standard.
The other thing that Doug taught me was the whole idea, and this is the Stephen Covey thing, the sharpening the saw, right? That was something that was really, really important in that environment, was that you're going to work hard and you're going to hit it hard. But part of that working hard is setting time aside for planning, dreaming, and goal setting, and doing that not only in an individual environment, but in a collaborative environment as well. And so that's always been something that's part of what I do in my week, because in publishing, especially, there's so many details. There's always a task. There's always something that can be done. There's always another call. There's always another email. But you have to find time when you can turn that off and say, okay, let's dream a little bit. Let's think about how we can do this differently, how we can do this better. And we've seen that in the publishing environment. It's interesting. We haven't talked a whole lot about it, but the publishing environment we're in right now, Passion Publishing is partnered with HarperCollins. So we're in a unique relationship with them, where Passion is determining what we are going to publish, how we're going to publish it, a lot of the creative, the development of the message. But HarperCollins, one of the five largest publishers in the world, is responsible for sales, marketing, media. They manage all of our inventory. So we've really had to figure out, how do two different cultures, how do we work together? How does this large publishing conglomerate work with this little boutique organization that's intensely focused on our specific messages? And so we've had to navigate, how do we find on HarperCollins, they have some tried and true ways how they publish books. And they've been pretty successful with it. And yet we have new ideas that we bring to the table that are constantly pushing against status quo. And so that's something we have to navigate in our partnership with them, on how do we effectively work together, where we're bringing the best of their world with the best of our world to get the most successful output that we can.
Well, you know, and we're getting close to where we got to wrap up here. So this might be a good segue. It's interesting, because I was thinking about this as my next question, and then you kind of went in this direction.
Sure.
So Louis Giglio has this, and Passion has this tremendous ministry going on that is widely recognized for their impact and their innovation and, you know, getting things across and changing people's lives. One of the things my clients run into a lot is, you know, how do you do something unique? So you've got your publishing arm.
Yeah.
You really don't want to be kind of an also ran, you know, type of thing that's kind of a blasé extension of this Passion ministry. What do you do really to take that so it really is, it's something that's adding fuel to the way you're igniting people's passions? It's something that's really contributing, and it becomes an important piece of the puzzle, because that's got to be a challenge in what you're doing, rather versus getting stuck in a square peg, or square hole type of thing with the publishing piece. I don't know, maybe I'm not articulating this well, but how do you balance that?
Yeah, so internally, and if I think I understand your question correctly, you know, I think what we have to work through, so in the publishing world, the general publishing world has a tendency to hold on to the status quo as long as they possibly can. I mean, the printing press has been around for hundreds, and you're an author, and so you probably experienced it. I mean, how they make books, how they promote books, how they market books, they tend to kind of use the same tried and true methods. And they do it for a short window of time. It's usually about 90 days where they really work hard on getting your book out there, and then kind of pull off the gas pedal a little bit. And so for us, the innovation hasn't come as much in the message in even the packaging. It's not like we're trying to create a new kind of book or something like that. But for us, it's about how do we reach out? How do we connect with people? And so publishers can be really, really great at leveraging opportunities, not as great with creating new opportunities. And so what we've had to work with HarperCollins is recognizing the fact that they bring some incredible strengths to the table. They have a global network of customers and outlets that they can tap into. They have a sales team that is reaching all over the country and around the world. They have impeccable relationships with the largest retailers out there and so forth. But HarperCollins, I would describe them as like a super tanker. They're really good at taking large loads of material and going from point A to point B. Then you have passion. Passion is about reaching new people, about innovating. It's about doing whatever we need to do to reach whoever we want to reach. We're more like a battleship. You know, we like to go out there and say, if there's action over there, we need to go over there and be part of that. And so we've had to really learn and work together on how do we make sure that we respect one another's worlds, we understand one another's value disciplines, and we're collaborating in a way where passion isn't constantly asking HarperCollins to do something that they're not built to do. And yet HarperCollins is willing to yield and allow us to go down some roads that every now and then make them feel a bit uncomfortable. And so for us, we're going to put more emphasis on not so much the efficiency of publishing like HarperCollins is, we're going to put more emphasis on the effectiveness. And if we can find that cross-section of efficiency and effectiveness, we feel like we're going to be much more effective in the marketplace. And so right back here, quick little example of that, we did a Bible that came out just this last January. It's called the Jesus Bible. And the reason I'm showing this right now, and I don't know if all your people are watching, some of them are probably just listening, but for those of you listening, it's a beautiful Bible that is linen, cloth overboard. We actually sourced this linen in Italy, had it shipped to China. We put an emphasis on this Bible on every aspect of the publishing inside out. It's a beautiful, beautiful Bible. Now, if we'd have just gone the status quo route, we'd have done an inexpensive Bible that was accessible from a financial perspective. It would have been a typical hardback book. We wouldn't have spent near as much time and effort and money on the packaging of it. And I think it would have done okay. But the interesting thing is we pushed to the place where the publisher of the Bible division went to the CEO of HarperCollins Christian Publishing and said, man, these guys are asking us to put way more into the packaging than we normally do, and they're not yielding on it, and it's going to blow our P&L. And the CEO ended up giving approval on that. But here's the thing that's really crazy. Number one, they have sold more of this study Bible than they have any of their other study Bibles in the last 3 years. Number two, we hit our 12-month projection in 4 months. And number three, if you go onto Amazon reviews right now, the third most common reason people are giving this Bible positive reviews is the packaging. They're describing it as one of the most beautiful Bibles they've ever seen. And so it's just an example of organizations needing to be able to come together and work in a way that you take these calculated risks where you go out there a little bit and you get behind resources. But at the same time, you don't go to such an extent that your partner is completely alienated, if that makes sense. So is that answering your question?
I think it's a beautiful answer because you gave it in a business context with a product.
Yeah.
But it actually totally transfers over to a leadership approach with individuals where you work with individuals based on their strengths and you combine your strengths with their strengths to have the maximum impact.
Yeah.
Unless you disagree. But I mean, that's what I also heard from you. But I wrote a note to myself. I got to check out the Bible.
There you go.
So I know you got a hard stop. So we're going to round up and end up. I really want to thank you for being with us. Any last comments you want to make to leaders out there as we close out?
I think just one more thing, and that is, if I were listening to this, I always ask leaders, you know, What do you think leaders need to know? What are, you know, what are the basic things leaders need to know? What's are the important things leaders need to know? And for me, it's just a reminder that every single person that is reporting into you that you're responsible for, that you have a relationship with, needs four things. And for me, I use the acronym BACK, B-A-C-K. They need belief, they need access, they need clarity, and they need knowledge. And if you're giving your people those four things, you're going to be a better leader for them, no doubt.
Awesome. That's a great close, Mark. Thank you, sir. Or Kevin, sorry, Kevin Marks. I'm messing up everybody's names today. Maybe I need another coffee. And so Jeff likes the bloopers when they happen anyway, because it makes the podcast real. But I don't know.
Your listenership will go way up.
Yeah, it's like looking at Louie on the sidelines. So thank you very much. I look forward to future conversations. Hope we can get to know one another better. I mean, this is awesome. Seems like we have a lot in common, which is what Mark said to expect. And Jerry was like, oh yeah, Mark, awesome guy. So I'm looking forward to it. Thank you very much. Thanks to our audience. And you have a great week.
Thank you. You too.
Thanks everyone for listening today. I really enjoyed getting to know Kevin Marks, our guest today. Really good stuff. I hope you enjoyed the show. My guest next week is Kurt Crum, and Kurt is coming back to us. So he is a special services manager with the Boise Police Department, and he's just got great perspective on leadership, and he is out there coaching, teaching, training leaders for department constantly. I don't think you want to miss it. He's always got great insights. So I'll see you then.